Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Biden abroad. The president meets with the prime minister of the United Kingdom ahead of the critical G7 summit and announces a plan to distribute vaccines to countries in need. Then Lone Star politics. Texas increasingly positions itself at odds with the Biden administration on critical issues. And AIDS at 40. We consider the effect of the virus on the communities it has disproportionately affected and what the future holds in the fight against the disease.
There's about a 10 million person treatment gap right now between the number of people living with HIV and those that are on treatment. And we're seeing increases in HIV infection in some parts of the world.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden kicked off his week of international diplomacy in a meeting with Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson in southwest England. It was the first meeting between the leaders, just ahead of the beginning of the G7 summit tomorrow. Mr. Biden also announced a significant step that he said would supercharge the global fight against COVID-19.
The United States will purchase a half a billion doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic. This is a monumental commitment by the American people. As I said, we're a nation full of people who step up at times of need to help our fellow human beings, both at home and abroad. We're not perfect, but we step up.
Traveling with the president is our Yamiche Alcindor, and she joins me now from Plymouth, England. So hello to you, Yamiche. It's evening there. 500 million doses, that is a lot. What more do we know about the President Biden's plans to contribute this money to countries that are struggling to get people vaccinated?
Well, President Biden in the White House is presenting this pledge to donate 500 million COVID vaccine doses to struggling nations as really a part of America's responsibility to help the world and also as being in America's interest to try to keep our own people safe. But it does come as the U.S. was facing pressure to do more to help other countries get vaccinated and as the U.S. was facing criticism in the way that we went about vaccinating our own people. So today the president spoke at length about this donation of 500 million doses. And what he said was that America steps up when people need us. He said that it is in the American way, the American value system, to be able to look at people and see them struggling and doing more. And he said it's our responsibility as Americans to help as many people as possible not die from this pandemic. And he pointed out that almost 600,000 Americans have already died from the virus. He also said, though, that this is because America will benefit from this donation. He said that the only way this pandemic is going to end is if people around the world are vaccinated. And he pointed out that there are variants going on, even here in the UK, that were originally in other countries. One of the highest variants that we're seeing in the UK right now, it originated in India. So this was really President Biden making that pitch. But the other thing we should note is that European leaders over and over again were asking, what else can the United States do? How much more can the United States do to help with vaccine donation? So that comes amid that. Also, you heard some European leaders, including the Prime Minister of Belgium, say that the U.S., the way that we were prioritizing domestic production through the Defense Production Act, that it actually upset the global supply chain. So that's an accusation that European leaders are making against the United States that prioritized making sure that Americans had the vaccine and that they were produced domestically.
And Yamiche, we know that President Biden also, of course, today was meeting with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Tell us more about that meeting and about how each of these leaders used it to advance their own goals.
Well, President Biden and the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson both said that they were really trying to underscore their value for democracy. And they also talked at length about the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. And they did two things. They, one, talked about a revitalized Atlantic Charter. Now, the first charter was signed by Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill in 1941, and it outlined the U.S. and British goals for how to end World War II. And this now revitalized 2021 version, the U.S. is saying and the U.K. is saying that this is really adding to that. talking about cybersecurity, talking about climate. One thing, though, that the president, President Biden, didn't bring up in his remarks afterward was Northern Ireland. Now, as a candidate, President Biden said that he wanted to make sure whatever agreement came out of Brexit and trade negotiations, that it did not upset the Good Friday Agreement that brought an end to sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, though, was out saying that the U.S. and the EU, they're all on the same page when it comes to making sure that peace in Ireland is preserved. So that's one place to watch as this all continues.
So many issues to follow. Yamiche Alcindor reporting on it all for the president's trip into next week. Yamiche, thank you. Jeff Zients is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, and I spoke with him earlier about the president's historic announcement. Jeff Zients, thank you very much for joining us. 500 million doses is a lot. I guess that's 250 million people, two doses a person. We know people are dying from this virus every day. I saw 10,000 just yesterday. So the question is, how soon is this going to get into the arms of the people who need it, and how much of a dent is it going to make overall?
You are right to focus on how does vaccine become vaccination? And in other words, how do you get needles in arms? There are strong plans in each of the recipient countries to make sure that the vaccines become shots in arms as soon as possible so that we can save lives. The 500 million doses today is in addition to the 80 million doses that the president announced a few weeks ago that we're sharing from our U.S. supply of vaccines, and we will continue to share additional supply across the summer months. You know, the U.S. is leading here. Other G7 countries and democracies are also donating doses. So this is a U.S.-led effort to vaccinate the world as soon as possible.
And I want to ask you about that. But in terms of the numbers, 200 million doses this year, 300 million next year, are those numbers driven by the Pfizer production capacity or by the U.S. budget, what the U.S. can afford?
No, we want doses as fast as possible. So the 200 million doses was a term that was very important to us to get as doses into this year, and that's the maximum that Pfizer could provide this year, and the 300 million will be delivered no later than the end of the first half of 2022.
Jeff Zients, there is a question about the Pfizer vaccine, and that is, this is a vaccine that has to be kept very cold. What about, was there consideration given to another vaccine that could perhaps be distributed to many more places that don't have cold storage?
Well, this is not mutually exclusive. The Pfizer vaccine is the mRNA technology, which has proven to be a very effective and very safe vaccine, importantly effective against all the variants. So it's important that we get those vaccines out to the world as soon as possible. Just this week, we've been shipping Johnson & Johnson vaccines, and we will do the same with Moderna from that 80 million that I described earlier of U.S. supply that the president committed to getting out the door by the end of June. And as I said, we will continue to ship from our U.S. supply across the summer months, and this 500 million coming online in August will really make a big difference for the world.
The president has said, Jeff Zients, no strings attached. But we know now that China and Russia have given a lot of vaccine to many countries around the world. Could this be seen as a kind of vaccine diplomacy?
Absolutely not. I think the president repeated it twice. No strings attached. No strings attached. This is being done for humanitarian reasons and to protect our own self-interest here at home.
Well, let me just pick up on the question about what more the U.S. can do, because you hear from public health advocates that it's all well and good to give the vaccine away, but what's needed is production capacity in the countries that can possibly stand it up. How much is the U.S. doing to help other countries manufacture their own vaccine?
Well, the Quad partnership, which was announced a couple of months ago, which involves Japan, Australia, India, and the United States, is about creating capacity for a billion doses. We're doing supporting efforts in South Africa and other parts of the world. So you're right, it's not just about U.S. manufacturing. It's also about building these capabilities across the globe, and we'll continue those efforts as well. as continuing to bring as many doses forward from our U.S. manufacturing capacity and from the U.S. supply of doses.
And two other questions. One has to do with intellectual property laws. The United States is saying let's waive those and let other countries have some of the know-how for how to make these vaccines. But not all of our allies in Europe feel the same way. Do you see that staying? Go ahead. I mean, how can that be overcome? Do you
think? The president has made his position on this crystal clear. This is a once-in-a-century pandemic, an extraordinary situation that's cost millions of lives, and it needs an extraordinary response. And that's why he is in favor of the TRIPS waiver. And he's made that clear. And while that's being worked through, we're doing everything we can to encourage companies to transfer technology and know-how to partners across the world.
And last question, we know so much progress has been made here in the United States, and yet only, 42% of Americans right now are fully vaccinated. There's growing worry about this Delta variant. Is there clearly enough vaccine for all Americans when the time comes for them to have it?
Well, of adult Americans, 64% have received at least one shot, and about 54% are fully vaccinated. And we have sufficient supply for all Americans to get vaccinated. And we will always maintain that supply. And I would encourage anyone who's not vaccinated to get vaccinated as soon as possible. If you are fully vaccinated, you are protected. If you're not, then you are not protected. And you're also putting your loved ones, colleagues, friends at risk. So please get vaccinated as soon as possible.
Jeff Zients, who is President Biden's coronavirus response coordinator. Thank you very much for joining us from Cornwall, England.
Thank you, Judy.
In the day's other news, U.S. health regulators have extended the expiration date on the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine by 6 weeks. That lengthens the shelf life from 3 months to 4.5 when stored at normal refrigeration levels. The announcement comes after state officials warned that many doses in storage would expire before the end of the month. The U.S. Labor Department gave a mixed economic outlook today. Unemployment claims fell for a sixth straight week to a new pandemic low of 376,000. Meanwhile, consumer prices in May increased 5% over the past year. That is the biggest 12-month inflation spike since 2008. Higher demand for goods and services as the economy reopened, coupled with supply bottlenecks, have driven that surge. There is movement in Washington on infrastructure. This evening, a group of 10 senators, 5 from each party, announced a bipartisan agreement. They still need to discuss it with their Senate colleagues and with the White House. But this new plan would add roughly $579 billion in new spending. President Biden had proposed a $1 trillion increase. Another Republican group had gone only as high as $250 billion. A reservoir that serves much of the western U.S. has reached a record low level as the region grapples with extreme drought. Levels at the man-made Lake Mead, located in Nevada and Arizona on the Colorado River, are expected to continue falling until November. That will put more pressure on the region's water supplies and electric output at the lake's Hoover Dam. The U.S. envoy to the United Nations called today on the Security Council to publicly address the conflict in northern Ethiopia. Fighting between army and rebel forces has ravaged the Tigray region since November. The U.N. estimates 350,000 people are grappling with food shortages there, and most of the region's 5.6 million people could face famine if the fighting escalates.
This is a region that even prior to the conflict has been affected by shocks in recent years. We had the desert locust this past year, hailstorms, some pockets of the region that are already chronically affected by drought. It means that this is an area that's already a bit on the edge.
The Ethiopian government has downplayed the shortages and said that food aid is being delivered. In Myanmar, a military plane crash has killed at least 12 people, including a well-known senior Buddhist monk. The aircraft went down in the central Mandalay region, reportedly due to bad weather. Army-run TV said that the plane was on its way to lay the foundation for a new monastery. Palestinian officials said that Israeli special forces shot and killed three Palestinians, including two military intelligence officers, during an overnight raid in the occupied West Bank. Thousands of mourners joined funeral processions for the Palestinian officers in the towns of Jenin and Nablus. Israeli media reported that the Israeli forces were arresting two operatives from a militant group when they came under fire. The wife of Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman admitted today in a D.C. federal court to helping her husband run his multi-billion-dollar criminal empire. Emma Coronel Aispuro pleaded guilty to three federal charges, including drug trafficking, as part of a plea deal. She will be sentenced in September and could face life in prison. Her husband is serving a life sentence in Colorado. And on Wall Street today, stocks shook off fears of rising inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 19 points to close at 34,466. The Nasdaq rose 108 points, and the S&P 500 added 19 to close at a new record high. Still to come on the NewsHour, we consider the effect of AIDS on the communities it has disproportionately impacted. The new film, In the Heights, lifts up Latin voices in Hollywood. And schools nationwide reconsider the presence of police among students.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The past legislative session in Texas focused on key conservative priorities, from restricting abortion to addressing transgender rights. The Lone Star State is now focused on a voting bill that would tighten election laws after missing an opportunity to get it passed late last month. We check in now with our political reporter, Dan Bush. He is in Austin. Dan Bush, hello there. So Texas has just ended its regular legislative session, and as we've said, they've looked at a number of conservative priorities. Tell us what's getting the most attention.
Well, Judy, the big issue was voting rights. Republicans have legislation that would do a number of things. It would limit drop boxes for ballots. It would limit vote by mail. It would also allow partisan poll watchers to monitor polling places around the state. In addition, it would also restrict voting for some hours on the weekend. Now, Republicans argue that all of these measures are necessary coming after the last election in order to increase transparency, to reduce voter fraud. Democrats, however, they argue that this is essentially voter suppression. Let's hear from one state senator now.
Well, it's Jim Crow 2.0. I mean, I can't say it any plainer than that. It's voter suppression, and it's targeting Harris County, right here where we are. I think because we broke a lot of records. I mean, the tremendous turnout. 1.68 million people voted in Harris County. Largest voting turnout. And I think that is what has concerned people on the other side of the aisle.
That was a Democrat back in Houston, Judy, and it's important to note that this legislation has not yet passed, but several lawmakers told me that they expect Governor Abbott, a Republican, to convene a special session a little later this summer where these measures are going to become law.
And so, Dan, tell us what more the legislature has been focused on, and how does it fit in with the national picture?
So the legislature got very busy the last couple of months here at the state capitol right behind me in Austin. A bunch of issues that came to the fore. One was related to gun ownership. The state passed a law allowing Texans to carry handguns without a permit, so loosening restrictions on gun ownership. Another had to do with abortion. The state passed a fetal heartbeat law, one of the most restrictive in the country, which would make abortion, which now has made abortion illegal in the state of Texas 6 weeks into pregnancy, even in the case of rape and incest. And when you pull back and look at the national picture, what you see here is Texas joining a number of states, Georgia, Arizona, others, where Republican-controlled state legislatures are doing everything that they can to enact a conservative agenda at a time when, in Washington, D.C., Democrats are in charge. They are trying to do, frankly, quite the opposite. Democrats are trying to pass legislation right now in the Congress to, for example, strengthen voting rights. But here at the state level, Judy, Texas and other legislatures around the country are moving forward with these conservative items.
Right. So important for us to keep an eye on what is happening in these state legislatures where so much of the action has now moved. Dan Bush, reporting for us from Austin. Dan, thank you. Four decades ago this past week, the first ever cases of the HIV/AIDS epidemic were publicly noted and hardly noticed. The Centers for Disease Control published a weekly report then, noting that five gay men in Los Angeles were sick with an unusual pneumonia-like infection. Two had died. By the end of that year, the CDC counted 270 confirmed cases of, quote, severe immune deficiency, the disease that later became known as AIDS, caused by the infection of HIV. Cases exploded around the world. It's estimated that about 35 million people have died from AIDS in the years since. William Brangham looks now at the progress made against the virus and the major problems that remain.
In the 1980s and early 90s, the AIDS epidemic was marked by two kinds of images. One we saw in public, activists taking to the streets, demanding not only action, but basic recognition that AIDS was real. President Reagan's administration often ignored the crisis. Reagan himself didn't publicly mention it for years. But the other was in private. In homes and in hospitals, patients, many of them gay men, wasting away from AIDS. The LGBTQ community lost a staggering number of friends and loved ones to the virus. With no medications or vaccine, contracting HIV back then was often a death sentence, a sentence shrouded with a thick blanket of stigma and denial. By the late 80s and early 90s, some small improvements. As well-known Americans tested positive and came forward, attitudes began to shift. And then, in the late 1980s, came the first antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV infection. A decade later, combinations of drugs proved the virus could not just be slowed, but suppressed. This huge shift meant people could survive, with HIV becoming a chronic but not fatal condition. But for years, those drugs were expensive and not available to people in sub-Saharan Africa. Millions died before new programs were launched to make those drugs more affordable and more widely available. Salim Abdul Karim runs one of South Africa's leading HIV research centers.
It's not that we don't know what to do. It's a challenge of trying to do what we know works and to do it at a scale where it can really make a difference.
HIV treatment has undoubtedly saved millions. Nearly 38 million around the world today, more than 1.2 in the U.S., are living with HIV. 27 million of them get that treatment. But AIDS still takes its toll. Nearly 700,000 people died last year, and millions still don't get the life-saving access they need.
So for a look back at this epidemic and a look at the best way forward, we turn to two people who are deeply immersed in all of this. Chris Collins is the president and CEO of Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And the Reverend Robert Newells is director of national programs at the Black AIDS Institute, an African-American-led research and advocacy group focused on ending HIV in Black communities. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for being here on this anniversary. Chris Collins, to you first. I grew up in San Francisco in the 80s. I lived in New York in the 90s. I have very distinct memories of this epidemic. For people who don't remember, can you just give us a snapshot of what it was like back then?
It was absolutely terrifying and tragic. I mean, I came out as gay a year before the MMWR was released. And as soon as that happened,
all of CDC first signaled that HIV was here.
That's right. And pretty soon everybody I knew was scared, worried for themselves, worried for all their friends. It was a mystery then of what was going on. And we saw our government not responding adequately to it. So it was a time of a great deal of fear, but also frustration and anger.
And Reverend Newell's, the same question to you. Do you have an early memory of this epidemic that you could share with us?
Sure. I grew up in Oakland, just across the bay from San Francisco, but I was 10 years old 40 years ago. And what I remember was seeing white gay men on television suffering from this new disease. But in my community, it was really a secret. We didn't die of AIDS in those days. We died of pneumonia or cancer. So it was that stigma that kept people quiet about it. So I really didn't see it as a black disease at that time.
And we certainly know how that has changed since then. Chris Collins, as I mentioned in the introduction, so much progress has been made. We have drugs that treat HIV. We have drugs that prevent HIV. So great success on one hand, and yet still a lot of faltering going on globally.
Well, that's right. I mean, the progress has been incredible in terms of where the science has taken us and just the mobilization that's been global to demand equity and scale up of things that work for people. But we're falling short in a lot of ways, as you say. You know, there's about a 10 million person treatment gap right now between the number of people living with HIV and those that are on treatment. And we're seeing increases in HIV infection in some parts of the world. And now, also because of neglect all over the world of marginalized people, people who are marginalized in their own societies, like gay men and other men who have sex with men, sex workers, people who inject drugs, trans people, others, you're seeing now an increasing share of infections are among those key population groups, those marginalized groups. And governments all over the world are criminalizing their behavior. Societies make them outcasts, and that makes them more vulnerable, and it makes it also very tough for them to access services. So we've got to turn that around if we're going to begin to end this epidemic.
And Reverend Newell's, we know that here in the United States that once HIV/AIDS sort of dropped off the front page, a lot of Americans thought, okay, we're done with that. But as your work certainly is a testament to, there is still a pocket where we have not figured out how to solve this in the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about where HIV is still prevalent in America?
Sure. In Black and brown communities, much like everyone has talked about with the COVID pandemic, HIV and AIDS is still really prevalent among Black same gender loving men, Latino same gender loving men, and Black trans women specifically, and cisgender Black women. So I think, and in the Deep South, because that's where most Black people in this country live, the HIV epidemic seems to be centered in big urban areas. There's a big problem in rural areas as well that looks a lot like it looks in sub-Saharan Africa.
And Chris Collins, with regards to those particular populations, you often hear this term that they are hard to reach. But I've heard many activists say it's not about hard to reach. It's that we know what works. It's just a function of finding the political will to do better. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, it is not easy to bring down HIV infection mortality rates, but we do know what to do. It's not rocket science. Communities around the world have actually dramatically driven down HIV incidence and mortality when they've gone to scale and reached everybody at risk. But what we've got in the United States now, really, if you look at the map of HIV incidence, it's a map of policy failure and the impact of racism in our society. It doesn't have to be that way. line up the states with some of the highest HIV incidence against states that didn't take the Medicaid waiver for Obamacare, for example. You'll see the impact of policy, failure of health systems to be scaled so that they can reach everybody. That plays out in more severe HIV epidemics. We can turn this around, but it's going to take political commitment and the investment.
Reverend Newell, you touched on this earlier, but I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the issue of stigma, because that seems to be still such a big impediment to getting people to care and getting good care to people.
Sure. Stigma, both individualized stigma, community stigma, family stigma, faith-based stigma, can prevent folks from A, getting tested to even find out what your status is, and then B, getting treatment. It's not always all about access. Access is a big deal, but access doesn't mean uptake. And so if you feel stigmatized by going to get treatment or services, then the access doesn't really matter. You're not going to uptake those services.
So Chris Collins, the COVID pandemic has certainly shown us how a virus loose anywhere in the world can be a threat to everybody. Going forward, with regards to the fight against HIV, what do you think we ought to be doing? What are the next most important steps to take?
Well, we need to make sure we're reaching everybody. One of the priorities that came out of the high-level meeting at the United Nations just had was to say we've really got to work with governments around the world and get rid of negative laws that criminalize people's behavior and that marginalize them in communities. Doing that and getting tailored services to those populations is going to be essential. We've got to increase investment. This is another thing the UN called for this week. We're underinvesting in ending HIV. We could bring this epidemic to near an end, but we've been underinvesting for decades now.
Reverend Newell, same question to you. Do you think we have it within our power to end the HIV epidemic?
We absolutely have it within our power. I think some of the lessons we take from the COVID experience that we've all shared is that the messenger really does matter. If you're trying to reach folks that you're not used to reaching, you're not going to be successful. So we have to invest in Black leadership, Black folks, reaching Black folks. The messenger matters when addressing medical mistrust. The history of that and the lived present-day experience that folks have with medical racism, like those are things that contribute to this pandemic, and those are things that we have to hit head-on if we're going to end it for everyone by 2030, as the UN would like to do.
All right, Reverend Rob Newells and Chris Collins, thank you both for joining us on this anniversary. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As movie theaters begin to reopen nationwide, blockbuster films delayed by the pandemic are now hitting the big screen. Among the first of the summer season, In the Heights, which opens today in theaters and streams on HBO Max. As Jeffrey Brown reports, this modern-day musical with a Latino cast front and center is set in a specific neighborhood, Washington Heights in Manhattan. But it has high ambitions of shaking up Hollywood and beyond. The story is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
In un barrio called Washington Heights, the streets were made of music.
I am Usnavi, and you probably never heard my name.
It's a big budget, big song and dance film about little dreams, or sueñitos.
And I built my little dream, my sueñitos.
In a community often overlooked in life and in Hollywood.
We're taking a flight to a couple of days in the life for what it's like in Washington Heights.
The specificity of the story is what made me feel so seen and so validated. I knew I wanted to be a part of this.
For once, says 26-year-old Leslie Grace, born in the Bronx to Dominican parents, that specificity is about Latinos living ordinary lives, not stereotypical film roles.
Hey guys, it's me.
Grace plays Nina Rosario, whose father has sacrificed all to send her to Stanford.
Look who's home!
With the weight of the entire neighborhood's hopes and expectations on her shoulders, a feeling she and others in this nearly all Latino cast understood all too well.
As you were growing up, did you see people like yourself? And as you're thinking and becoming a young actor, did you feel like there were roles for you?
I didn't. A lot of us didn't. A lot of us didn't have the fortune. And that's why I think we all felt like Nina at a certain point, feeling responsible for this story and immortalize it in a way that would make people feel seen and would make little boys and girls feel like, oh, they look like me and I can do that.
In the Heights, the theater musical opened on Broadway in 2008 and won a Tony Award for Best Musical. It was Lin-Manuel Miranda's first big show before the smash hit Hamilton. And he wrote it with Kiara Alegria Hudis in part to create new roles for Latino actors like himself. This time, Anthony Ramos plays the lead character.
And Steph.
Miranda has a small part as a street vendor and large role as producer. And he and now screenwriter Hudis have teamed with director John Chu of Crazy Rich Asians to turn the real Washington Heights into a grand stage. The bodegas and salons, apartment buildings and fire escapes, the hot summer days. A place where people from different islands, nations, and backgrounds can together build a new home.
Combing the stars in the sky.
Olga Meredes plays Abuela, or Grandmother Claudia, the matriarch of the block who encourages its young residents to remember their past while chasing their sueñitos. Meredes is a theater, TV, and film veteran who remembers the days of being cast as maids and other marginal characters.
So many stars.
Here in the role she originated in the theater production, she's given a show-stopping number, Paciencia y Fe.
Mama says we're poor. One day you say, vamos a Nueva York.
Lin-Manuel Miranda took this invisible character, you know, this person that maybe if she was walking down the street, you would not see her. And you would kind of say, move out of the way. I need to go where I need to go. I'm humbled to give her the platform that she deserves.
In one scene, Abuela Claudia shows Nina some hand-embroidered napkins her mother had made. This, too, hit home.
Sometimes we have to find those little mementos, those things from our past. I have albums of pictures from my Cuban family, so I don't forget where I come from.
According to a 2021 UCLA study of Hollywood diversity, while Latinos make up nearly 19% of the U.S. population, they account for 29% of movie tickets sold, yet still get fewer than 6% of all film roles. In the Heights changes the picture in an interesting way, normalizing Latino life on screen, according to Chon Noriega, director of the school's Chicano Studies Research Center.
What really struck me just early on is just you get those details, and the details are not narrated to you. You're hit with a lot of things that are just day-to-day life. The nature of exchanges, the types of products, the way people dress.
The food, of course, that we're seeing.
The food and the ways in which they interact with each other that are marked not by being a homogenous population, but by being internally diverse within one of the most diverse cities in the world.
Noriega cites past moments for Latinos on screen. Desi Arnaz in I Love Lucy, the films La Bamba, Zoot Suit, and others. The more complicated example of West Side Story, where, the great Rita Moreno aside, most Latino characters were played by white actors. A remake by Steven Spielberg due out in December promises to change that. But bigger change?
You kind of pick up on a sense of doubt about it, because over the long run of the last 40 to 50 years, it hasn't changed. This is a great way to call that question. It's good to be hopeful about it and to see this as something that can be not the signal of change, but a launching pad for further change.
Olga Meredes says now is exactly the moment for In the Heights.
This movie is a game changer. I don't know if it's the timing of the, you know, we're finishing this pandemic, thank God, and people are just craving for joy and light and music and positivity.
Can we raise our voice tonight? Can we make a little noise tonight?
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
We could use a lot of joy and can't wait to watch that one. And we'll be back shortly with the story of a student who changed the way her school uses police. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. It is an important change in parenting here in the U.S. More and more older adults are raising children for the second time around because of illness, incarceration, addiction, or any number of reasons. Stephanie Tsai reports on these grandparents and what they are up against in the pandemic.
One, two, three.
Joanne Clow brought up two kids on her own. She never imagined that she'd have another child to raise at the age of 64, a very lively one.
It's just not something you economically plan for. I'm a single grandmother rolling the rock back up the hill.
How old are you, Carter? There's no way you're four. You look like you're five.
Bomber, bomber, what do you see?
Carter's mother, Emily, Joanne's oldest daughter, died of a fentanyl overdose in 2016.
I every day grieve Emily's loss of Carter because she'll do something cute, or, and I just think, oh my God, Emily, I can't believe you're missing this. You know, I just can't believe you're missing this.
The opioid epidemic has contributed to the growing number of grandparents raising grandchildren, says gerontologist Megan Dolben McNabb.
There is a priority within the child welfare system to place children with relatives whenever that's possible. And that's due to the fact that it's helpful to maintain those connections.
Give lovey kisses.
It also saves the system money, a cost that is often borne by grandparents who can't afford it. 19% of grand families live in poverty.
Many of them are on limited incomes. For many grandparents, the addition of those expenses really kind of overwhelm the resources that they have.
Lisa Lennon was making it work with a cleaning business that allowed her to support her grandkids, 12-year-old Luke and little Jackson, still in diapers. But since the pandemic, she's lost most of her clients.
You barely keep your head above the water, and that doesn't feel very good. It doesn't allow me to feel like I can provide everything Jackson needs, everything Luke needs, and also survive.
Behind on rent, she's worried about getting evicted.
How are you doing with food?
We get food from the church and we run short toward the end of the month, but we stretch it out and make it work.
Since the start of the pandemic, almost 40% of grand families say they struggle to pay for housing. A third have trouble accessing food.
I wish I had someone's sofa that I could lay on for 2 hours and just cry my eyeballs out.
Having a good cry would be a luxury these days, says Lisa Banks. She's got three grandchildren at home doing virtual school.
I'm trying to spread myself thin amongst three kids, which is difficult. A lot of the work I don't understand because I've been out of school so long and things have changed so much.
And with no school lunch, the dishes and the bills are piling up.
It's like, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry. You hear it all day. So it's breakfast, it's snack. It's lunch, it's snack. It's dinner, it's snacks. You're spending it more in utilities because they're using more electricity. Everything goes up.
Any of this stuff here, you can take as much as you want.
Banks recently found some help through a local nonprofit group called Gratitude for Grandparents. Every Sunday, founder Rhea Kelsall distributes donated food and essentials from her basement.
So many of the families had part-time jobs that lost their jobs. They have less income now than they had prior to the pandemic. Gratitude for Grandparents is here for them.
Kelsall herself can relate. She and her fiance are raising two grandchildren between them, also because of substance addiction.
Carl's my fiance's biological grandson, and his dad is deceased from an overdose. I do sometimes think that the big G had a plan because we understand what the other one is going through.
And they've gone through a lot. The latest hurdle, the pandemic forced Kelsall to close the daycare she was running.
Totally lost my income, and now we're on his fixed income.
Kelsall, like most grandparents, is raising the kids outside of the foster care system.
They're your blood. You want to take them home and take care of them, love them, and everything else. It's not even a consideration.
But without legal custody or guardianship, it can be tough to tap into government support services.
There can be eligibility requirements that push some grandparents out, and many of them really struggle.
Nonprofits like Kelsall's are trying to fill the need, which includes emotional support. we joined the group's monthly Zoom meeting.
I just wanted to see if I could see a show of hands.
I asked who thought the pandemic had compounded the challenges they face.
Me.
Not surprisingly, every hand went up.
Never did I think I would be this short of breath.
61-year-old grandmother Kim Aaliyah was recovering from COVID-19.
My oxygen was at 86, and I was truly afraid to die because what would happen to Brooklyn?
Brooklyn is the 11-year-old grandchild she's raised since she was a baby.
It was absolutely mind-numbing, the fear that I had.
With the cloud of COVID, there's worry.
I wake up thinking about these kids, and I go to sleep thinking about them.
With the shadow of the past, there's worry.
They've experienced a great deal of trauma in their lives. And I mean, what they need, they can't have, their mother.
The grandkids' mental health weighs on Paul and Barb Anderson.
This thing of the kids going to school on the computer and not having a social life just exacerbates the problem, I think.
Oh, we got the kale too.
As heavy as the burden may sometimes be, the children, says Lisa Lennon, are also what lift her up.
They're my inspiration and reason to wake up these days.
On good days and bad days, says Lisa Banks.
You go through those moments, you go through those stressors, you cry, you fight, you argue, whatever it takes, but you're still there at the end.
And that's what really matters. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
The role of police officers in schools has come under increasing scrutiny as communities across the country respond to calls for racial justice and reevaluate student safety. In Los Angeles, student activists played a major role in getting the school district to move away from funding police in schools. Julia Escobar from the NewsHour's Student Reporting Lab's Youth Journalism Program at Venice High School has the story.
After George Floyd's murder, the call to get police out of public schools grew much louder.
There is no reason why we need school police officers in our schools. They don't help us.
Kalila Williams is a senior at Girls Academic Leadership Academy in Los Angeles. She's a part of a group of activists known as Students Deserve who have succeeded in getting millions of dollars diverted from police in the nation's second largest school district.
A lot of people undermined us as students, saying that, you know, there's no way that students can make this happen.
But they did. Student and community activists successfully pushed the Los Angeles Unified School Board to divert $25 million from law enforcement. That's about a third of what the district had been spending on its school police force.
Black students feel criminalized, have been pepper sprayed, arrested. What else do you need?
The cuts mean more than 100 officers were laid off and the use of pepper spray was banned. Officers used to be stationed at every high school and middle school, but now they will no longer be present on campuses, although they will still be on call to respond to problems. The board voted in February to use the divested money specifically to support Black students. As a part of the district's ongoing efforts to address systemic racism, the funds will go to LA schools that serve predominantly students of color, and the district is now hiring more counselors and staff to provide social emotional support. Nick Mulvoyne is a school board member who supported the change.
We are a school district that is 89% of color. I'm a straight white man. I don't have the lived experience of all of our students. And so listening to them was so powerful and actually understanding how my decisions were affecting their lives.
You know, I don't want to do anything around a school police officer. And, you know, people may seem like, oh, that's a good thing. That means there's no crime. There's no drugs. There's no this. But what that means for Black students is that's more trauma. More fear. They're scared when they're on campus.
Pedro Noguera is the dean of USC's Rosser School of Education. He's a sociologist who has studied disparities in the education system.
Schools have to be safe. No one can learn in an unsafe environment or even a chaotic environment, right? You know, we need safety and order for learning. Question is, what produces safety and order?
Moni Cephas-Luce is another student activist who believes having police on school campuses does not mean students are actually safe.
What safety is being able to be who you are without fear that somebody else who doesn't understand you is going to threaten you.
But Sergeant Rudy Perez sees his job differently. He joined the district's police department 20 years ago. He grew up in Guatemala, where he saw corruption among police. But when he came to the U.S. and attended Los Angeles schools, he says the police officer at his high school inspired him to stay on track, and he wanted to do the same for others.
I love to mentor, lead, and protect kids safely through graduation. That's what I live with.
One criticism of school police is that, like, when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Why, like, what would you say to people who argue that police officers are just like the wrong tools to have in schools?
A teacher, you should have the ability to de-escalate this fight. Don't call the police till somebody gets hurt or now there's a victim.
Perez did not lose his job in the layoffs, but he believes the decision to divest money was unfair to law enforcement.
It was done for something that happened in Minnesota and it didn't happen here. It didn't matter whether you were a park ranger police officer. It didn't matter if you were municipality. It didn't matter whatever it was. The badge and the uniform got demonized.
Just by virtue of having a police officer on campus, you increase the likelihood that kids will be arrested for things that they should have never been arrested before.
According to the American Civil Liberties Union, students are 3.5 times more likely to get arrested on school campuses where police are present compared to those without.
I'm not against having law enforcement around if their job is to keep the school safe. But when you see law enforcement doing the work of school administrators, then it's inappropriate.
Similar conversations about police in schools are happening in at least half a dozen other major cities around the country.
So it was like a celebration for LAUSD, but I also hoped that it was going to be a celebration for things that could come in other places.
$25 million will now be supporting positions and programs designed to help Black and Brown students feel safer in schools. But that money is less than 1% of the district's $7.5 billion annual budget. The changes happening here are now allowing for a larger conversation about how best to support students in all aspects of their educational experience.
I'm just amazed that this actually happened. I never doubted us, but knowing that this is actually like for real is just an amazing feeling.
For the PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs, I'm Julia Escobar.
An important story worth exploring further. And there is more to explore from our student reporting labs. A new podcast, On Our Minds, with Noah and Zion, offers a unique opportunity to show what mental health really looks like for young people, what kind of services are available to them, and the real stories behind the statistics. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.